Hey everyone, welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly. This is Insight is Capital. If you've spent any time around younger investors, or honestly, around any investor who's curious and has a Wi-Fi connection, you've probably heard the name Ben Felix. He is the Chief Investment Officer and a Portfolio Manager at PWL Capital, co-host of the Rational Reminder podcast, and the person behind one of the most watched evidence-based investing channels, Ben Felix, the Ben Felix channel, on YouTube. And here's the thing. The people watching him aren't just DIY investors trying to avoid paying for advice. They're your clients. They're your clients' adult kids. They're the people sitting across from you at discovery meetings who already know what a factor tilt is and have strong opinions about fee structures. Ben has built something rare, a massive, genuinely loyal audience that trusts him because he gives them the full picture, no product, no agenda, no axe to grind. Today, we're going to find out what advisors can actually learn from that and what he thinks the advice industry still gets badly wrong. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Ben, welcome to the show. It is truly terrific to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ben, I have to say, I've watched an embarrassing number of your YouTube videos. Like, the algorithm has a grip on me. They're really good. I have to say, I'm impressed, and you know, by the material and the ground that you cover, often in 20 minutes. It's really fantastic. It's not hard to understand why you've achieved a following of well over 500,000 subscribers to your channel, to your personal channel, never mind your other podcasts. Before we get into the more serious stuff, tell us a little about yourself. Mechanical engineering to ultimately chief investment officer. What was the actual moment where you made that turn?
It was more accidental than a conscious decision. I was playing basketball in the United States. I did my undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering at Northeastern in Boston on a basketball scholarship. And I had finished playing there and was going to come back and play. I had a little bit more eligibility. I'd finished my degree at Northeastern. I was going to come back to Canada, do some kind of degree and play a couple more years of basketball. Basketball was the main motivation. So I went to Carleton University, which is, it was then, and it continues to be one of the best basketball programs in Canada. I mean, they've won the vast majority of the national championships in Canada over the last 20 years. Anyway, so I chose Carleton because I wanted to play basketball. And then I had to pick a degree program, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do professionally. So I kind of thought if I did a master's in engineering, then I'd probably have to work as an engineer. And I figured if I did an MBA, then I could probably work as an engineer or do some other thing. So I chose that path. And then I chose finance out of the MBA streams because it was supposed to be the most challenging one, which is the same reason I picked engineering when I went to Northeastern. So that was kind of it. So I started studying finance. I did like it a lot. I kind of took to it quickly. And then I did an internship program in financial services. So that was about, I don't know what it was, 10 months or something of an internship. Started to really enjoy that field. And I was able to pursue a career as soon as I finished my MBA. And I've been at the same firm. I graduated. I don't think I was even done school yet. I was almost done my MBA. I started working at PWL Capital, where I still work today. Finished my MBA and then went and did the CFA program and all that stuff. And it's been great. So I'm super happy that I came into finance and super happy that I landed at the firm that I'm with today.
I bet. I had a good chuckle when I was reading your very brief profile on PWL's website, and the chuckle was something people don't necessarily know about me. I'm 6'10". But I thought, you know, just to connect it to your basketball student athlete life, that's something that's probably something for probably a lot of people, do you find it something that they have to get used to? Like when you walk in a room, or I mean, do you have to duck when you walk into?
I do have to duck under most doors.
Mm-hmm.
My kids think it's pretty funny. They always ask if I can hit my head on the door if we're in a new place. People definitely have to adjust to it. It's kind of funny. If I'm with people that I know, it's usually whatever. Like it's, you know, they already know what to expect. But if I'm meeting new people, or if I'm in a place where I have not been before, I get a lot of looks, a lot of people asking me questions, which is, you know, a lot of people ask me if I'm annoyed at how often I get asked about how tall I am. And it's something that's been happening to me. I remember that the first time it ever happened, I was, it's probably 17 years old, and I was like 6'9" at the time. And I went to a school on Vancouver Island out in BC. And everyone knew me there, and it was whatever. They'd known me for years as I had gotten taller and taller. And then I took the ferry over to Vancouver, to the mainland, for the first time since I had been really tall. And I couldn't figure out why everyone was looking at me. And I'd later realized it was because I was unusually tall. And so now I don't even notice. My wife will, if we're walking together, she'll say, "Do you notice all the people looking at you?" I honestly don't.
That's pretty funny. You get used to it very quickly, obviously.
Yeah.
So 6'10", that's something.
Yeah.
Ben, thanks for sharing that trip that you took from mechanical engineering to finance. I really love what you're doing on YouTube. I you know, I'm sort of like a lot of people in the industry, a lifelong student of markets and investing. And it's one of the parts of the business that I truly enjoy. I think it's one of the things that a lot of advisors and professionals in the field really love about the business, is it just when you think you know something about investing, you realize the more you know, the less you know. And you know, you kind of have this moment where you capitulate and you realize, you know, all this stuff that I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out was actually meaningless in the big picture. And there are some very important things that are extremely meaningful. Your videos are a reminder. These 20 to 25 minute presentations that you do on YouTube, you cover so much ground. How did you come to that, and what, how has it evolved into what are you actually trying to accomplish?
So the content started, it was a PWL Capital initiative. We had a lot of success with blogging back in the 2010s. I joined PWL in 2013, I believe. And, or maybe it was around there. And, Justin Bender, who's still one of the portfolio managers in our Toronto office, he had been quite successful with writing a blog about index investing. And it's interesting. It was at the time met with a bit of skepticism, from the firm, where it's like, do you really want to give away all the secrets, you know, not secrets necessarily, but give away the secret sauce of how we do everything, how we manage portfolios, how we think about all the different pieces that go into building a well-designed ETF portfolio. And Justin's view is that, yeah, we should be doing that. And so it was a bit of resistance. This is before my time, but there are stories about this, kind of part of the firm's lore. And it was wildly successful. So Justin's blog became very popular. His writing led him to link up with Dan Bortolotti, who at the time was writing the Canadian Couch Potato blog, which was hugely popular about index investing back then. And Dan eventually joined our firm. And so together, Justin and Dan were unbelievably successful in writing really, really high quality blog content. And that resulted in a lot of new business for PWL. So any doubts were very quickly quashed, and content became something that we realized was an advantage for us. And so around maybe a couple of years after I had joined the firm, our marketing director at the time brought to the leadership team the idea that, you know, blogging's been great for PWL, video is going to be the next big thing. And there was a bunch of data that she had presented about how much online consumption was shifting toward video as opposed to written content. It was a really good case. And so we decided, yeah, we're gonna lean into that. And the way that it worked was the firm said, any advisor who wants to create content, you have to come with your first 15 ideas for episodes and a channel concept. And then we had hired an external consultant who would do they would come and they would record us, they would do all of the editing and post-production, and they would do a little bit of help on scripting. And so that was the initiative, and a bunch of people did come forward and start creating videos. I was the last person at PWL. It took me about a year after that initiative had started to put my hand up and say that I was gonna try it out. I was very nervous in front of the camera early on. You can still see it in my older videos. I'm like super rigid and stiff and monotone. It's kind of funny to go back and watch. But it was also hard to come up with content ideas. So it did take me about a year. I remember I was sitting in the parking lot in Costco, and I messaged the consultant that we had hired, and I was like, I think I've got the idea. And I explained the channel concept, which is very similar to what it is today. And I had written down my first 15 ideas. And then I started making videos, and I have never stopped since. And it's been, it turned into something bigger than I think we were ever expecting when we started.
To touch on one of your points, I think, you know, like this business is very competitive. You know, when advisors have a successful marketing strategy, they're not likely to share it with anyone around them, except, you know, maybe a close associate, a close friend or partner. I remember chatting with somebody and them saying, you know, so what? Like, if you tell the whole world what you do and mostly how you do it, they don't know what the pretext is to all of that. They don't know what the underlying work that you do underneath all of that amounts to. And so you can see where the tension was in the firm,
yeah,
around, you know, giving away the secret sauce. But in reality, there's always, you know, with investment anyway, and I'm sure it applies elsewhere, there's always a fair amount of cognitive dissonance as well that goes along with it. Yeah, I know, you know, those are the right things to do, or that's the right way to approach it, or that's the right way to think about it. But, you know, I still like my way.
Yeah, I think there's that. And it's also hard. Like the execution side of all of this stuff is hard, and it's hard because there are actual practical implementation steps that you have to take on an ongoing basis to build and maintain a portfolio. There's all of the decisions around the portfolio, like the asset allocation and all the other financial planning decisions that go into portfolio management. And then there's sort of like the cognitive dissonance. There's just the mental overhead and the psychological barriers to doing what is right. Even if we give you the recipe, this is what you should be doing. To your point, a lot of people won't do it, either because they don't have the time or because some other bias is getting in their way. They don't think right now is a good time to invest because of whatever is happening in the world and all that kind of stuff. So I think that's what we found, is that if we tell people exactly what we do and how we think about financial planning and portfolio management and how they can do something very similar or even the same as what we're doing for our clients, some people are going to take that, they're going to do it, and that's great. And they're going to be successful do-it-yourself investors, and then good for them. But a lot of people, enough people for it to be very beneficial for us as a firm, are going to look at the content that we put out and say, yeah, I can see how I would do that, and it makes a lot of sense, but I'm not going to do that. So I'm going to call PWL and they're going to do it for me.
Yeah. I love the parts where you get in your, you know, where you get to sort of the segue in your video and you say, you know, and before I get into all the geeky stuff, before I get into the geeky, you know, stuff that you love, it's a terrific demonstration of your capabilities as a firm. And, you know, if you had to think about it, like, what does getting this wrong look like?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I mean, if you're putting out content that does not demonstrate expertise or comes across as a sales pitch, rather than saying, here's how you would do this, or here's how you should think about this thing, if you make content that says, that makes it seem like a black box, and that you, the advisor, are the one that can solve it for people, I think personally that sends a very negative message to potential clients. it seems like it should attract people because they're thinking, oh, that's really hard. I can't do it. So therefore I should call this person. But I think it sends the wrong message. I think it makes people feel like they're being sold to, which actually pushes people away as opposed to attracting them. So that'd be my biggest concern with somebody making content. Other than that, I think where this can be challenging, and one of the reasons that, you know, you mentioned earlier that people would hold their best marketing ideas close to their chest, I'm more than happy to talk about this and how well it's worked for PWL because I know how hard it is. And so when I think about where can content go wrong, other than sending the wrong message, which has obvious issues, if someone says, I want to do content, I always kind of smile and say, you know, good luck. Because it's hard. It's really hard. It's hard to do good content. It's hard to think about the ideas and it's hard to execute. It's hard to write down a script. It's hard to get in front of the camera to find a 20-minute quiet window with no meetings and no kids if my kids are home and whatever to sit down and record. Every step along the way is hard. So that's, I think, one of the biggest hangups for people is that it is a genuinely a hard thing to do. And one of the most important things about doing content, and you of course know this as well as I do, is being consistent. If you post a video randomly every few months, you're not going to build a following. You're not going to gain momentum. You got to post consistently, and it's got to be good quality content consistently so that you build that following and build trust with people. And that's really hard.
Do you ever not feel nervous doing this?
I don't feel nervous anymore. Now, after almost 10 years of doing it, I'm kind of over that now, but it probably took me, I don't know. It probably took like 5 years, honestly, of being in front of the camera before. I think it was like 3 years before I cracked a smile in front of the camera and showed some emotion. So that part's hard too. I didn't even mention that, but that's a whole other thing where I think people will get in front of the camera, feel uncomfortable, look awkward maybe because they do feel uncomfortable, and then they'll watch the video and be like, oh, that's terrible. I don't want to publish that. And then it's easy to give up on that basis. But pushing through that kind of thing is just, it's part of the path to creating content.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. It's it's on the surface. I think, you know, people even look at, you know, what's going on in social media and, you know, the more successful influencers on social media, for example, and it looks easy, but there's nothing easy about it. There's absolutely nothing easy about it.
Yeah.
You talk a lot about your process and your thinking and, or the thinking behind your process. What's the thing that you see happening in the industry or that is sort of maybe still pervasive in the industry that you can't say out loud, but you believe it anyway?
Our approach is pretty simple. I'll just start with that. We take the approach that markets work is kind of the highest level of abstraction. We don't think that we can pick stocks. We don't think that we can time the market. We don't think that third-party managers that we could hire or buy the funds of can do that either. And we think there's a lot of data supporting that position. So we just try to capture market returns, and we do that either using low-cost index funds or a higher proportion of our assets are in funds from dimensional fund advisors, which are principally very similar to index funds, but they tilt a little bit towards small cap value, high profitability stocks, and they do a little bit of stuff around the edges to try and make trading a little bit more efficient than it is in an index fund. But it's broadly speaking very similar to the concept of index investing. It's cut from the same cloth. Another way of saying markets work, and something that I kind of somewhat jokingly say often, is that investing has been solved. The optimal portfolio, the optimal investment products, like we kind of know what that looks like. A lot of people might still try and optimize and chase performance and try and pick winning managers and all that kind of stuff, but in general, that doesn't tend to work. So just capturing market returns is pretty sensible for most people most of the time, and that's what we do. Now, as much as I believe that, and as much as that shift has been happening in Canada a bit, in the United States has happened dramatically, the shift toward indexing and lower cost systematic strategies. In Canada, there's still a lot of other stuff that I think gets put into client portfolios. Traditional actively managed funds are still out there and still still pretty dominant in the Canadian marketplace, so we do still see a lot of that. Something that has really come up in terms of prevalence over the last few years is alternative investments. So we've seen more and more private equity, private credit, which has been interesting because as previously the head of research and more recently the CIO of PWL, I entertained various pitches from private asset managers, and we kind of kicked the tires and thought about, should we be doing that? Some of our peers in the U.S. who do use for public markets a very similar philosophy as us have gone into alternatives, and so that made us think, like, maybe we should be looking at this too. We ultimately decided not to go that route, and right now that is feeling pretty wise because we are seeing from, to answer your question, a lot of the transfers that we're seeing come into PWL do have meaningful holdings in private asset funds that are currently gated, and the clients have decided they don't want to invest that way anymore, but they don't have a choice. They're stuck.
Right.
For now, for the time being, we'll see how that plays out in the long run. But that's probably the biggest shift that I've seen, where I think that the idea that index funds make sense and that active funds don't really beat the market has permeated throughout the population of investors, broadly speaking. And so I think that the idea that an advisor can use an active fund as part of their value proposition, I think that has gone away largely. However, I think it has been alternatives have taken the place of that. So to the extent that advisors were using, I'm not saying all of them are, but to the extent that advisors were using actively managed funds as part of the value proposition, I think that because investor opinions have shifted on that type of product, alternatives have really replaced it to the extent that advisors are using products as part of their value proposition. And that's something that PWL has very intentionally stayed away from. It's really similar to actively managed funds. It's just antithetical to our investment philosophy.
In terms of, you know, sort of being the chief steward at PWL, how does there's two questions here. One is, how is the transformation for advisors joining PWL? And the other question is, how, when you see, you know, when new clients are transferring into PWL, how well does it go? Like, do investors, clearly when investors decide to come to PWL, when new clients come on at PWL, it's because of an attraction of one reason, or, you know, for one reason or another. There's a culture shock, right? I mean, advisors coming from bank-owned brokerages to join PWL is one cultural change that must be fairly significant.
Yeah, so I'll start with advisors, and this is one of the unintended consequences of us having the content channels that we have. The vast majority, if not all, of the advisors that we have at PWL right now have come to our firm because of our content. And that's something that's like, you know, we thought maybe we could get some new business, some organic growth by creating content, just as we had done with blogging. I do not think that we didn't expect it to be sort of a beacon for advisors. And so we don't usually facilitate that transformation for advisors because it has already happened by the time they come to PWL. And that's happened historically, organically, where we had advisors who were at a competitor firm or at a bank or whatever. They started listening. It's usually our podcast. They started listening to the podcast, got through enough of it where they really felt like they had a strong affinity for the way that we were approaching investing and financial planning and our fiduciary duty and all that kind of stuff. And they would get in touch and say, like, I really want to come work at PWL. And we've had such strong organic growth over the last 10 or so years that it's been great because we can hire advisors and just fill them up with clients through organic growth. So we get these advisors who have gone through their own transformation and they've kind of, you know, seen the light, if we can say that, and decided that they really are aligned with the way that PWL thinks about financial planning and portfolio management. And they call us and say, I really want to come work for you. And we say, great. So that's been cool. More recently, something that has changed for PWL is that we were acquired in January of last year. And that acquisition didn't really change anything in terms of our regular operations. Like, our leadership stayed the same. All our team stayed the same. Nothing changed. Our fees, like, everything stayed the same. The one big difference, other than having very smart people to lean on for leadership type decisions, the main difference for our business, though, has been that we have basically a blank check to acquire like-minded advisor teams within Canada. So if we find a team that's a good fit, One Digital, who now owns PWL, will help us with the M&A due diligence, and they will write the check to acquire them. And so that's been a little bit different, where it's not so much an advisor that's coming to work for us as an employee and we're filling them up for clients. These are advisors who have established practices, established portfolios, and they're now coming to PWL. However, it has been pretty similar, where the people that we've acquired so far have been people who heard that we were acquiring teams and growing through acquisitions. And they were longtime listeners to our podcast. And so they would put their hands up and say, "Hey, I want to have a conversation." And those are usually pretty smooth, because their portfolios usually look very, very similar to ours. In the cases where they have been different, part of that conversation is about, you know, we don't want to have a whole bunch of different models over time. And if we just start acquiring people and allowing their existing models to continue, it'll get very messy very quickly. So part of that acquisition conversation is about rationalizing their portfolios to be much more similar, if not the same, as ours. And honestly, so far, even when the portfolios have been materially different, people have been very receptive, because I think we make a very strong case for the way that we invest. We communicate it in a way that clients are going to be comfortable with, and that's really what advisors care about. In my experience, advisors have their convictions in whatever they've been doing, but what they really care about is how a change is going to affect their clients and how their clients are going to feel about that change. And so I think if we can instill confidence, and I think we can and have been able to, that we will be able to help through that transition and bring clients on board with our philosophy and approach, advisors seem to be very happy with that. So that's advisors that we've hired as employees, advisors that we've acquired, and slightly different, but kind of similar. And then for clients, this one's super interesting. So that organic growth that I mentioned that we've been able to fill up our advisors' workloads with, those are largely people who have come to us either through our content or through a client referral. And in both cases, they're coming to PWL already bought into the investment philosophy. Sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes we even have people who are so excited to work with us, it feels like they're the ones selling up about why they should be a client, as opposed to us selling them. Cameron Passmore, who's the CEO of PWL,
right?
He and I, early on, when I started working with him, we realized that when someone comes through the door and has no idea what we do and are expecting something different, if they're expecting security selection or manager selection or whatever, selling that person on what we do is a losing battle. It just does not work well.
Interesting.
And so we abandoned that approach. We used to do advertising on the radio and other sort of just wide net advertising. And people would come in the door not really knowing what we do. And we'd have to try and go through that sales process. And it was brutal. It was grating. It wasn't enjoyable. And it was largely unsuccessful. But once we pivoted to creating content and building a following of people who are aligned with what we do, believe in what we do, and know us and trust us, it completely changes the sales process and sales cycle, because now people are coming through the door knowing exactly what to expect, both on the financial planning side and the portfolio management side. In many cases, they even know the advisor that they end up working with, because we'll occasionally have our advisors on our podcast. So it's been honestly transformational. It's been great for growth, for sure, but just the whole process of selling and attracting people and convincing them about what we do now happens asynchronously, and people self-select as potential clients, as opposed to us trying to convince them.
I can't help thinking that. You know, one point that you made was that so many unintended benefits arose from the content. But when you create the content, who do you have in mind for the content? Who is this for? Whenever you make any of your videos?
Yeah, it's a good question. We know that our audience roughly consists of DIY investors who will never become a client, DIY investors who may become a client at some point, maybe clients of other advisors, probably out there too. Other advisors are for sure a big part of our audience because we hear from them all the time. They're people who do academic research, like often the people whose research I cite, they might watch the videos. So that's kind of the audience. I do try to speak to sort of a blended mix of that, of sort of a intermediate level DIY investor and an advisor is probably who I'm most speaking to. In Canada, ideally, like a decreasing proportion of our audience is Canadian, just because the content has continued to get reach outside of Canada, but it's still disproportionately large. We have a big home country bias in our audience, which is a good thing. I would say it's an intermediate DIY investor to an advisor, some kind of blended mix of that avatar.
You can see where, like you mentioned, for example, you know, DIY investors, you're not sure if they'll ever become clients, but they might just be younger and not at the stage yet in their lives where family, you know, have family or responsibilities beyond just whatever they're saving and investing. But they evolve, right? Those younger clients are the future clients.
Yep.
Who come in when they're 35 to 40. They're not coming in at 24 to 30 necessarily, yep. But when they're 35 to 45, they might just show up on your doorstep because they've been following you for that amount of time, right?
Yeah, for sure. We've seen that. We've seen that transformation where someone will come and say, you know, at this point, when we're doing content for so long, they'll say, I've been listening to your content for 10 years or whatever it is, maybe 9 years. And now their life's gotten more complex, or they've had a child, or they've incorporated, right, or whatever. And then now they want to become a client. So that's been interesting. I think a more common outcome that's, again, an unintended consequence that we wouldn't have necessarily predicted is people who are successful DIY investors and they're doing great on their own and they will never hire an advisor. I often hear people say that when they're getting older and worried about cognitive decline, that's when they would hire an advisor. But anyway, a lot of people just say, for example, that they'll never hire an advisor. Those people, because they are so ingrained in our content, or our content is so ingrained in their heads, they'll often refer family members. And these people become just fierce advocates for our brand and our service, even though they'll never use it themselves. But they trust us on such a deep level that if their parent or sibling or whatever it may be needs financial advice and needs an advisor, they will advocate very strongly for PWL. So that's something that, again, like creating this big army of people who will advocate for our service to their friends and family, just because they love our podcast so much and they know exactly how we think about all the aspects of the service we provide. We did not predict that. I mean, it's kind of that idea of, you know, maybe you don't want all these DIY investors listening to your content, but I don't know, maybe you do, because not everybody they know is a successful DIY investor.
They're not necessarily all like-minded.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. When you actually think about what an advisor does, investment is just one dimension of it. I think a lot of advisors hang their hat on securities selection. But if you get into the topic of advisor alpha, for example, or, you know, Russell's value of an advisor equation, if you haven't already as an advisor sort of, you know, glommed on that, you know, and realize that securities selection is just like one or four or five key dimensions of being an advisor that you can provide to your clients to sort of solidify your value case, then you're really, you know, missing it. And something like your process, your evidence-based investing process, ultimately frees the advisor from the securities selection trap. What have you seen within your firm that's allowed it, you know, has it given advisors that latitude to explore all these other planning dimensions with their clients?
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that we talk about as being a major benefit of this philosophy, is that we're not spending time choosing managers or stocks, or going back and questioning whether that was the right manager or stock to pick and whether we should change things. Those are all time-consuming activities. Important for somebody who's focused on doing that, for sure. But for us, we've said we don't think that we can add value there. We're not going to try. The market has delivered, and we expect it to continue delivering strong returns for our clients. So we're just not going to spend our time trying to outperform it. And our clients are self-selecting as agreeing with that approach. So that's all good. Everyone's aligned. We're all expecting the same kind of things. And that has absolutely freed up our advisors' time, but I think our whole firm's time to focus on things that we actually have more control over. You can't control whether the stock that you pick or the manager that you pick is actually going to outperform. There's going to be a distribution of outcomes. Our view is that the evidence suggests that the distribution slants a little bit negative for those activities, which is why we don't do it. But there are things that have much more reliable, positive expected impacts on clients' long-term outcomes. And it's the kind of stuff that, you know, you don't have to apologize for if it doesn't work out, which we also like, and I think our clients also like. We actually just had I talked about it on our podcast that'll come out in the next couple of weeks, but we had a client who fits the profile we've been talking about. They're a DIY investor who's been successful. They've built wealth. They've been successful professionally, and the portfolio is growing. And they decided to hire PWL. And then they wrote about their decision in like a group chat, I think, with a bunch of their friends. And then they sent what they posted in that group chat to the PWL advisor that they're working with, who then sent it to me. And I was like, hey, can you get permission for us to talk about this on the podcast? And we got permission anyway. So this is a whole long this long thought process about all of the reasons that they had decided to work with an AUM advisor, which is something that even this client was surprised about. They had expected to go looking for a fee-only financial planner and continue their DIY investing journey. But they listed out all the reasons they chose an AUM advisor, and none of them were related to managing the portfolio. It was all about financial planning, getting rid of the cognitive load, having a third party to be there to communicate things to their spouse, having protection against their own cognitive decline, having continuity of their plan in the case that they, who are the primary financial spouse, is not able to continue managing the finances their spouse would be taken care of. They had some complexities about citizenship in another country that they had just been kind of ignoring, and they knew that there were some planning opportunities there. Anyway, so they made this whole list of reasons, and none of them were beating the market or picking managers or whatever. So I thought that was really telling, and it is anecdotally what we see from most of the people that decide to work with PWL.
That's very revealing. I mean, that's a very revealing, look at what actually matters to clients. To get it anecdotally and through the process that you just described is very enlightening. I hadn't even considered, for example, the cognitive decline angle, but it's very real. It's a very real threat. Health is a very real threat. It's probably one of the biggest ones, most underestimated threats that can affect anyone financially profoundly. Yet those are the things that people are actually thinking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Related
to health, something that we do that I think new clients find really compelling is we built out this a goal setting process. That's another thing where, because we're not talking about, you know, which stocks we're going to pick, we can really focus on what the client's objectives are. And there's some really interesting research showing that if you ask someone what their financial goals are, they will not give you good answers. And they won't give you answers that they themselves would evaluate as good when they're presented with other goals that they may have selected if they had thought more broadly. So we created a structured goal setting process based on some published academic research about objective setting. And we then actually tested our process. We got 310 people who were mostly listeners to our podcast to go through this process. And then we did some analysis on it, but we also had Morningstar's behavioral research team do some analysis on it. And they did find that people had set much more meaningful goals after going through this process. But anyway, up front with clients, we always do that. And they find it really, really valuable. I mentioned that related to health because one of the steps in that process is to present categories that goals might fall into. And for those categories, we use the letters or the categories in the PERMA model, which is a model of well-being, of human flourishing. PERMA V, so it stands for positive emotion, engagement, relationships, meaning, accomplishment, and vitality. And vitality is all about health and sleeping well and exercising, all that kind of stuff. And so clients go through this process and they'll often realize, you know, I'm not putting enough emphasis on my health. And then we help them think through the how to plan for that. How does that fit into their financial plan? How does that fit into how much they're spending, how they're spending their time? And it becomes a really valuable part of the overall process and setting up a relationship for success. That's another one of those things where we're focusing on things that we can control. How can we guide the client toward a better life as opposed to trying to knock out of the park with a stock pick, venture pick, right, or a private equity fund or whatever.
I suspect that that's one of the most, you know, those areas of planning. I mean, as a trusted advisor, you have so many opportunities to engage with, you know, clients and their whole families. There's all these other areas that you can actually get down to and start to run your advisor practice more and more like a family office and less like a brokerage.
Yeah. We recently built out, well, we haven't really named it yet, but it's a financial planning checklist. That's underselling it. It's a very cool app, a web application, but it has, it was basically everything we could think of that we might consider recommending to a client in all of the major financial planning categories. And so that's something that we're rolling out to our advisors so that as they're going through their client relationships, they can go through this really comprehensive checklist of basically everything that they might need to think about for the client and make sure that every client is getting that level of service and thinking. One of the reasons that we were able to do something like that is that our PWO's business model is that the advisors are not independent contractors, which is, I think, a pretty common setup.
Right.
They don't own their books. Our employee advisors, they are hired and they're employees, and we give them clients. When we acquire advisors, they become employees. They sell us their book. And so we have one service offering, one business model, one investment philosophy, and all that kind of stuff. So we're able to systematize things like what is PWL financial planning offering, and then scale that. And it's been a very cool project. And I think it's something that's really valuable both to our advisors to make sure that there's quality control and consistency, but also to the clients that they're able to deliver that to.
One thing that I, you know, get from listening and watching podcasts is that you really get to know somebody if you watch them enough, like watching your videos. It's not that I got to know you, Ben, from watching your videos, but I feel like I know you. I feel like I have a sense of who you are, your personality, your belief system, your values are sort of come out in your videos. What do you think when people are watching your videos, what do you think it is that they trust in your process?
I do hear from people in comments on videos and when they're discussing my channel online, like we have a social listening tool called Mention. And so whenever someone mentions my name or a podcast name, I see it anywhere on the internet. I also often see people on Reddit or whatever saying, you know, you should go check out Ben Felix's channel. Here's why. But the big things that get cited there are my professional experience. Like they'll say he's the CIO of PWL. My credentials used to get mentioned more, less so now, maybe because my title is enough to, you know, give that credibility. But I'm a CFA charter holder, CFP, CIM, PLFin in Quebec. So that stuff I think does matter to people a little bit. But then the biggest thing that always comes up is that I base what I say on research and evidence, which is something that's like coming from the world of engineering and just a STEM education to start. That's like, of course, that's how you should approach this stuff. But when I first started in financial services, I realized quickly that is not how it's often approached. And when I found index investing and dimensional and PWL and the focus on financial planning, I was like, okay, there's actually a way to do this that's pretty evidence-based and scientifically rigorous to the extent that you can be in finance and economics. And when I realized that at first, when I saw what financial services looked like, when I got my first taste, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to stick around, but I very quickly discovered kind of the way that I think that should be approached that I now continue to like and employ. So that's what people like is that it's, I say things that are evidence-based. I link to the papers that I'm referencing. So that if people want to check my claims, they can go and read the analysis themselves. If I'm doing my own analysis, I'm very clear about my assumptions, how I got to my end result and all that kind of stuff. So I think people really appreciate that. And I think it's unfortunately very uncommon in finance and in financial services where there are a lot of claims that get made that are really hard to back up or easily contestable, or in a lot of cases, a lot of claims get made based on, and I've got a video coming out about this, so I've thought about it quite a bit recently. A lot of claims in financial advertising are just made based on what I would call intentionally incomplete information to try and persuade people. And people aren't stupid and they figure that out pretty quickly and they realize right. that they're about to get duped, or maybe it takes them a couple of years and they realize that they have been duped. But I think because I present everything clearly and provide evidence and provide sources, it's to a lot of people, it's just refreshing. It's like, oh, this guy's talking like, you know, somebody from a STEM field would talk, but he's in finance. That's kind of cool.
Strictly unbiased.
I mean, I try to be.
Yeah.
You know, I have my own beliefs and biases, but I do try to be as unbiased as possible. And I do try to present both sides of arguments, which people don't always listen to. You know, I've done a lot of content on renting versus owning a home, and I will often present both sides yeah. of the argument. I'll say, you know, here's what my analysis suggests about renting not being as bad as you might have thought, but here's all the reasons that buying a home can still make a lot of sense. But people never get to that part of the video. They usually look at the title, maybe watch the first 2 minutes, and then rage comment about why I'm wrong.
Unrecoverable expenses.
That's it. That's exactly it.
I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that one. Where do you see this all going?
Yeah, I mean, I continue to enjoy writing videos and making videos and interacting with the people that are watching my videos. So like I don't plan on changing that. I think it's a lot of fun and I find it very engaging. I mean, I mentioned the PERMA model a minute ago. So that's positive emotion, engagement, relationships, meaning, and accomplishment. I get a ton of engagement from the process of creating videos. I think there's a lot of meaning in it because I hear from people all the time who will literally tell me that my videos or our podcast changed their lives. And it's just like, you can't buy that feeling of people telling you that. So it's very rewarding. I'm going to keep making videos for the foreseeable future. It's a big part of PWL's ongoing growth story. And now that we've sort of unlocked this acquisition growth path, I think we're in a really interesting place as a firm right now. We don't have specific growth targets, but we want to be the firm in Canada that is doing our approach of whatever you want to call it. We don't actually love the term evidence-based investing, but that's a commonly known term. So that we want to be the firm where advisors who want to manage portfolios the way that we do and focus on financial planning and be fiduciaries, we want to be the firm that those people all want to come to. And it's underway. It's happening. A lot of the advisors who are in this space, who think like us, are joining our firm, which has just been fantastic. So we want to keep going down that path. The only other thing that I'm thinking about is eventually writing a book, which is something people ask me about all the time, but it's just a lot of work to like sit down and, you know, writing a video is a lot of work. Writing a book is a whole other animal. So we'll see.
If someone, whether that's an advisor or investor or both, listening to this changes one concrete thing, just one, tomorrow morning, what should it be?
From an investing perspective or a life perspective or what? Anything?
Anything.
I one of the most powerful frameworks that I've come across is that PERMA model that I've mentioned a couple of times now. And I think using that as a filter for how you live your life is really powerful. I think a lot of people spend time and money on activities and stuff that is not contributing as much as it probably should to them living the best life possible for them. So really looking at how you spend your time and how you spend your money and considering how that relates to positive emotion, which is feeling good in the moment, engagement, which is doing things that are challenging and meet your skill level, relationship, which is having strong relationships with people in your lives, meaning, which is doing things that are larger than yourself. Like for me, that's creating content, like I mentioned, and accomplishment, which is accomplishing hard things. So if someone's going to change one thing, I would look at that framework and think about throughout the day, how they spend their time, how they spend their money, what they're doing with their career, and how well it aligns to the factors in that model. I love that too, because I talk about factor investing and the PERMA model is a 5-factor model, but for living a good life instead of for portfolio management. So we've got two 5-factor models. One for investing, that's the Amen French 5-factor model, which we have not talked about, and the PERMA model for human flourishing or well-being. So that, taking that model, thinking about how it can apply to your life, if you can change one thing, I think it can be very powerful.
Ben, that's, I mean, we covered a lot of ground. That was a terrific conversation. Thank you so much for joining me and coming on the show today. I'm a big fan. And where can people who don't know about you find you?
Yeah. So as you mentioned in the introduction, I have my YouTube channel, which is just my name, Ben Felix. I've also got a podcast called the Rational Reminder Podcast. For advisors who are listening, it's on a bit of a hiatus right now. I think it's been actually 2 years since we posted an episode, but we did a third podcast called The Money Scope, which was targeted at incorporated professionals. So investing in financial planning for folks with corporations. I know a lot of advisors love that. So that's it's like super, super nerdy, but if people are into that kind of thing, it's I've heard it's an interesting listen. I thought it was interesting, but advisors seem to like it too. So those are the three big content channels, and I'm on other social media, LinkedIn, Twitter, and all that kind of stuff.
Excellent. I'm going to take a look at PermaV.
It's cool. My most recent video, which is actually my best performing video that I've ever posted on my channel up to this point, like in the first 3 weeks after posting. There are other ones that have been up longer that have more views, but this one in the first few weeks is the best performing video. And it's all about that. The whole video is about that concept and how you can apply it to your life.
Fantastic. Ben, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight. It's been wonderful having you.
Well, thanks so much for the invitation and great questions. I thought it was a good discussion.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Thanks, Pierre.